Hello and welcome to the Vinyl Exam, the podcast about vinyl records and the people who collect them. I am your host, Sam Ahmed. Today's episode picks up from episode 167 in our continued discussion with Jesse Brenner, aka The Bizzle.
So it actually came to me in a dream. Yeah. And I didn't realize all the various things it meant when I came up with it. So the 4.5 or 5 months I was in Botswana, over half of that I was living in very poor or very rural or even like in the bush type scenarios where people spoke little to no English. And so while I would never say I'm fluent in Setswana, which is the main language of Botswana, I had to get fluent in it enough to be able to communicate with people and conduct the research and projects that I was doing there. And the languages of Southern Africa are very related, but in Setswana and I think in Xhosa and in Lesotho, which is a related cultural group and so forth, there's a lot of grammatical similarities. And the prefix mo means one, di means two, like a pair, and ba refers to, you know, three or more, like a plural. So what we kind of came up with, because the name came first and we loved it, was like one to many. Oh, from one to many. It's like from one to many, like building a collective, you know, like this is great. But then very soon we realized two things. It was very close to Madiba, which is the, you know, name that people in South Africa who love Nelson Mandela, which is most people called Nelson Mandela, was Madiba. And also the first democratic leader of Mali was Modibo Keita. Which I did know that. That was very much in the back of the head. I did know Madiba, but both of those things factored in along with the Setswana stuff. So there was a lot of stuff going on. But yeah, from one to many was sort of our motto early on, and we just kind of stuck with it. Yeah. And I get to appreciate it now as a, you know, as an advisor and kind of a shareholder and whatever in the company. But it's still a very small company, and we're very much a boutique company that is very selective with the artists we pick. We don't have that many because we want to give everyone our full attention. And so that's never really changed. We will, I will say really quickly, we tried to start as a record label at the time when record labels were dying, and it, you know, it became increasingly cheaper to make albums. Obviously, because, you know, computer technology, which meant more people were making their own albums. They didn't need record labels, but it's also still so expensive to do marketing, to do promotion, to do all that stuff. And so now we actually manage a lot of the artists that we used to record because they ended up being very unhappy with their large management groups, and we were very unhappy and losing money on distributing records that were getting critically acclaimed and selling pretty well for what they were. But, you know, no matter how many Bombino vinyls you sell, it's still not going to compare to, like, you know, Drake, you know. So we sort of shifted. We also do music publishing where we advise. We have artist-friendly agreements with probably over 100 artists from around the world at this point, where we can represent their music, but it's not exclusive. So they can still do other stuff with their music, and they can work with other people. But if we get a job, they're like, hey, we're making a movie based in Rwanda, and we need some Rwanda music, we can go to our people in our network and help do like some licensing and publishing stuff as well with that.
Sure. Well, okay, let me put it from the perspective of the artist. And, like, you know, let's pick a specific artist, say Bombino. Like, what is the work that you do specifically with Bombino, for instance, if you could talk about it?
He's a Tuareg, obviously. You know, he grew up in refugee camps like a lot of Tuaregs. And a lot of Tuaregs were very rebellious for understandable reasons, but then they embraced music as an alternative form of integrating into society and forming a livelihood and just artistic expression for the stuff they were going through. Because, you know, so for people who don't know, Tuaregs live in the Sahel, which is between the Sahara of sort of northern Africa, which is more Arab, and the sub-Saharan, you know, Africans that you're sort of more used to thinking about or seeing. And so they're not quite Arab, and they're not quite sub-Saharan African, both in terms of their look and their culture. They generally speak Arabic, but they speak other languages as well. But they really embrace blues music, and Ali Farka was a huge part of it. Because Ali, along with Bouba Boubacar Traore and some other innovators in Mali realized that the pentatonic music system in Mali, in particular in West Africa, was extremely similar to the blues. And a lot of ethnomusicologists have established that there's really a direct line between West African pentatonic music and then the slave music that came to America, which then became the blues and jazz and rock and roll and so forth. And so, but anyways, via Farcatore had heard of Bambino, as had we, but Via had connections and knew people who knew him because geographically they're not so far away, northeast Mali and then sort of northern Niger. And he was like, dude, you gotta check this guy out. And much like Ali, who was in hiding for a while, it was hard to find Bambino, but we connected with the guy who made the documentary about the finding of Bambino. I forget. Yeah, Ron Wyman, I believe, is the name of the director of that film and that project. And I can't remember the exact story. You guys can look it up online in the documentary of finding Bambino, who is sort of a local legend. And through Via and through mutual connections, we offered, you know, we'll say, look, we'll help you get record deals. We'll help you get tour. So basically what it means is you are their personal representatives in all of their interests. So it's not an agent, right? So an agent, like in film or television or whatever, they're a complete middleman between studios and artists, and they're trying to make deals for everybody so that they can benefit, which is fine. Managers are like, you specifically are representing the interests of the artist at all times, and your, to be blunt, your financial future in regards to them is completely based on you doing right by them, getting them as much work as possible, not overworking them, but also working them to their full potential and getting them out there. Luckily, with artists like Via and Bambino, they're so spectacular, especially in their live performances, that does make our job easier. But when you're dealing with visas and then, you know, all the anti-immigrant stuff in this country and visa situations and the costs of flights and rerouting them, you know, across six continents around the world, it can be very, very confusing. But we basically help manage all aspects of the career. So the albums, the tours, the licensing, the media appearances. My partner Eric, who's the guy who runs Modiba now, basically, who I started with, has been fluent in French since he grew up. He's from Toronto and went to a really good private school in Toronto growing up. And in Canada, a lot of people, a lot of students learn French growing up, obviously, because of Quebec, and there's a lot of French Canadians. So he was already fluent in French, got even more fluent living in Africa. So he still has to like do all the translations with Bambino on interviews and stuff. So sometimes Bambino's like in Africa or in Europe or in Asia. Eric's in New York, and the person interviewing is in France, and you know they're doing a conference call, and Eric's trying to translate everything as much as possible. So there's a lot of aspects to it, and it's really exhausting, but it's incredible. Rewarding because way more than being record label, because you get to be involved in every aspect, and you get to really to befriend them and hopefully earn their trust and have them trust you to make good decisions. But also, to be a good manager, you need to listen to them, even though they might not on paper know as much as you about the music industry, which is probably for the best because there's a lot of crap in the music industry. But you have to listen to what they want and try and make it happen in a way that is compatible with reality, if that kind of makes sense. Det lilla lager Mandela, det området, säg vill du mig vänta ett år eller två, som om det är min sorg förgånga. Jag vill kan jag vänta ett år eller två, jag fast i vore allt ut i 20 år, som om det är min sorg förgångna. Och det är lillom krydde salt ut i brudskrud, men ögonen det leker till sjöstranden ut. So Ali Farcatore was ultimately, quote unquote, okay. So Ali was a legend and had toured for a while and then disappeared off the face of the earth. And a brilliant, brilliant producer, musicologist, ambassador to the arts in Africa from England by the name of Nick Gold, who runs World Circuit Records, People you might know of the Buena Vista Social Club project. He was behind that as well with Ry Cooder, and Ry Cooder has done album. He did an album with Ollie. There's a small group of people who's very involved in this. Even people like Peter Gabriel, for example, have been very instrumental in the birth or rebirth or whatever you call it of modern African music in the West. But Nick in particular, Nick Gold, has just an unbelievable ear for the most talented artists. I mean, pretty much all the artists that I still consider the best, from Umu Sangare and Ali Farka and Mali to Dimi Mintaba, the legendary female singer from Mauritania who passed away a couple years ago, but her niece is still singing. Unbelievable album. I mean, he was just like digging up these treasures. But unlike a lot of, in my opinion, shitty producers from the 80s who were like putting synthesizers and way too much instrumentation over African music, Nick Gold was like, nope, we're... Not only were you going to go acoustic, or if it's electric, like straight to the amp kind of thing, but he would go out to Ali's farm in Niafunke, which is near Timbuktu, and just record the album in like a shack in Ali's farm, and it still sounds better than anything out there. I mean, the Niafunke album, which was recorded in Ali's homestead, is probably, in my opinion, the greatest African music album ever in the modern age. And Nick knew Via through Ali, but Nick thought that, and this is not a diss to him at all, because I'm about to tell you why. Nick thought Via was too rough, but more importantly, Ali did not want Via to be a musician. It's very, very, very hard, because Ali went through a lot of trials and tribulations in attaining early success and then getting very poor and getting lost sort of in the metaphorical wilderness. And eventually Nick Gold found him, got him back on tour, made his best albums, and, you know, got not, you know, ridiculously wealthy, but by Mali standards, he made a very good living that he absolutely deserved. I mean, I would argue he deserved even more, but whatever. But Ali wanted Via to like go to the army or be a businessman or whatever. So basically we screwed up that plan royally, even though we worship Ali. My buddy Eric would just go secretly jam with Via on his days off in Mali when he was living there, and they would just like jam and Ali knew it was happening, and in the end totally gave the blessing to the whole thing. I mean, you have to understand, when we went to Ali's homestead in 2005 and made the proposal to do Via's album, we had done a project called ASAP, the Afrobeat Sudan Aid Project, where we did a compilation of new hot Afrobeat music along with some licensed Fela Kuti and Tony Allen tracks. Speaking of which, we actually managed Tony Allen now, who's still alive. Fela Kuti's drummer, yeah, we managed Tony Allen, but at the time we didn't. And we partnered with with Oxfam. And then after the Sudanese government kicked out Oxfam during the Darfur crisis, we then were able to partner with Save the Children, who I think because of their religious charter were able to get away with some of their humanitarian stuff. We also were lucky to hook up with people like John Prendergast and like very high level humanitarian and not political figures, but like diplomatic figures, including Samantha, what's her name, who was our UN ambassador for a number of years under Obama. Shit, I'm blanking on her name, but she was very involved in the Darfur thing. John Prendergast, I had a family connection with. He was like the foremost, you know, very early outspoken advocate to, you know, of what was going on in Darfur. And so there's just a lot of stuff coming together, and we're like, you know what, this is a great first project. Thank you. this is a crazy story. So me and Eric's other best friend from college, Aaron Thaler, who sadly died of brain cancer when he was 30. and he studied in South Africa while Eric and I were studying also abroad. But in the middle of his stint, he had a really, really bad series of seizures, and they brought him back to the States, and they said he had inoperable brain cancer at like 23 years old. And they gave him a year at most, and God bless him, he made it at least 7 or 8 more years before it finally they couldn't stop it anymore. Just a wonderful guy, one of the great jazz collectors ever. I mean, he introduced me to like all the coolest jazz of all time, a jazz guitarist himself. His dad grew up on Long Island, and his dad's best friends, is for real, on Long Island growing up were Ben and Jerry. And Ben and Jerry, other than making great ice cream and being awesome hippie dudes, are two of the most politically active and amazing people on the planet. In fact, right when the Darfur crisis started, they were on the front page of the New York Times. They chained themselves to the fence of the White House in protest of lack of action of Darfur with nobody else, just Ben and Jerry. Locked them and they got arrested. They arrested Ben and Jerry for locking themselves for protesting the lack of action in Sudan. So we came up with this crazy idea about the Afrobeat Sudan Aid Project. We put a demo together. We had already been interviewing and meeting and hanging out and getting to know a lot of these underground Afrobeat artists, including Antibalas, but including a lot of less well-known artists as well, Koya and a bunch of others in New York at the time. And we just went to them with this big-ass proposal, and we thought we were asking the world. We said, look, we're going to need about $6,000 to do the production of the album, and then the printing of the CDs, initial print, will probably be like $3,000. And we thought we were asking the world for like $9,000. But they saw one look at how much work we put into it and our vision, and then listened to the music. And they're huge Grateful Dead and Fish fans and stuff like that, classic rock fans. I mean, Ben and Jerry love good music and good jam music. And let's be honest, Afrobeat is great jam music, right? Yeah. And so they were like, yeah, we'll give you this money. Not only are we going to give you this money, we are not even going to recoup any of it. So the first $10,000 didn't go to funding them back. It went directly to Oxfam and then Save the Children. We got on the front page of iTunes. We were being interviewed by the New York Times, by Business Week, by Forbes. And we raised about $130,000 in about 3 weeks for that project. Fast forward a year or two. We're at Ali Farka's house. So we did accomplish one great thing. We also had befriended Via very closely and befriended a lot of African musicians. However, we were a bunch of 23-year-old hippie upstarts with big ideas. And Ali just had that old wise man, you know, instinct. And he looked us up and down. And he didn't talk very much. And after a very long silence, and I was like shaking both from nervousness to just being around his presence. Also, I should mention Tumani Diabate was there, who's the legendary kora player who is the best friend of their family and actually helps manage their finances because he's very business savvy. And the musician community is very close in Mali because it's their one big export, you know, in Mali. And so Tumani was there. It was very nerve-wracking. And Ali was just like, okay. And that was it. That was it. He gave us the okay. We said, look, we have the money. We have the funders. They've agreed to it. Here's what it's going to cost. And man, did the session take so much longer than we thought. We had to raise so much more money than we thought. We had to bust our asses to find a world music label that was small enough to take us seriously and really get behind it, but was big enough that they had distribution, like legitimate distribution. And it was World Village Records, which I'm not sure is around anymore, owned by a lovely man named Rene from France. Eventually took on the project, and that was it. We were off, and we did his entire first tour. And this is what we didn't realize early on. We were managing Via even while being his record label. And in principle, that's a conflict of interest. but it really wasn't. It was just us doing everything to try and make it work, and we were still losing money. We were just trying to make the project work. And then we got totally screwed over because a woman, who I'm not going to mention, who knew the family, really took advantage of us and swooped in right when he started getting really famous and signed him to a management contract. And we got, like, no money from anything, basically. But when Via realized, and I should say, Via is a lovely, passionate, loving, amazing guy. He was a real sharp-mouthed hothead when he was younger. He put us to shame. He was very difficult to deal with in the early years, but a lot of it was just because he was from royalty in Mali. Like, he was a prince, like, legitimately a prince in his country. And he had as much confidence in his talent as he deserved to, but he also didn't realize how rough it was, and also how much work he needed, and also how much help he needed. But once he realized that the manager that swooped in was screwing him over and screwing us over, and realized how much he liked working with us and needing us, was right around the time we were making the shift to management, and we basically all came together at the same time. We're like, look, we're getting out of doing music label stuff. We want to be management. He's like, I want you guys to manage me. I'm sick of this bullshit. I trust you. You launched my career. And it was just a total meeting of the minds. And ever since then, he hasn't lost an ounce of his fiery personality, which is amazing because his live shows are just off the chains, you know? And he's just a great, great guy. His English has gotten really good, so he's awesome at doing interviews now and stuff like that. But it was just like this immediate understanding. It was also around the time we were 27 and 28. I don't know if you agree with me, but I'm starting to think that, like, adulthood, especially for men, happens around 27, 28 years old. I feel like there was a major change in me. There was definitely a major change in Eric and a lot of our friends. Definitely a major change in Via, who's almost our exact age. And it was just a meeting of the minds. And it was like, okay, we're going to do this together. And so he was our first label artist, and then he was our first management artist. And then the rest is history. And, you know, we faced some early bumps in the road that you might not expect. Like, so Wesleyan is extremely liberal. And I thought going to Wesleyan, coming from a somewhat conservative area, but being raised by Jewish, secular, liberal, very liberal family, but growing up in a kind of Christian conservative area, I thought I was like I was accused of being a communist and a, you know, an atheist and stuff in high school, things like that, you know, and try to be recruited into like Christian youth groups because I was a child of the devil for being Jewish and I needed to repent. And I was I had people legitimately worried about me going to hell. Like, they weren't actually trying to offend me. They actually thought I was going to hell because I was Jewish. So I thought I was the most liberal person on the planet. And even in my family, who, you know, has been extremely active in democratic and progressive politics since the 20s, essentially, with my grandparents, I was even considered liberal in my own family. But I got to Wesleyan, man, and oh my God, I was a moderate at best there. And so when certain people at that school heard that a bunch of white guys were recording African artists, that was all they needed to hear, and we had to really fight against people who claimed to be activists and that we were appropriating African culture for our own gain, which, of course, again, I've never seen a penny of actual profit from this even today. Like, I lost serious money, and I'm happy to, over the years, but I've never seen a penny. And given this was also during the Afrobeats and A project, it was what specifically a charity project, which we didn't make one penny on and never intended to. But we faced a lot of criticism from people who thought that we were neo-colonialist, appropriation type people, blah, 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 blah. And to be fair, you know, when you're in college, especially when you're a small town, a small private college with a lot of rich kids who think they're, you know, super righteous, things get blown up in that kind of bubble. And some of those people I ended up really befriending later on once we graduated, and some probably still hate me till today. Because I was the guy who wasn't afraid to speak out against what I consider to be, how do I say this? Levels of political correctness that lead to paralysis of zero action, but even more so, lack of dialogue. Like, where you shame certain people into not even being able to talk or engage in certain issues. So if you are a straight white guy at Wesleyan, like, you know, like it was a thing, and you know, I wasn't afraid to speak out occasionally there. So we faced a little opposition there. Mostly in the end, though, people really supported us, and we actually got a lot of support from both the student body and the governing body at Wesleyan. In the long run, we helped organize, you know, trips down to D.C. You know, the Holocaust Museum in D.C. was hosting some of the early sort of Darfur anti-genocide conferences and stuff like that, and, you know, organizing trips down. So once people realized that we had our hearts in the right place, it was fine. But we still faced it in New York, and it's totally fair. Like, I totally would be suspicious too, depending on my upbringing and so forth. But to us, it was so obvious that, you know, our hearts were in the right places. And so we learned how to talk about it to people. We learned how to discuss it with people. We learned how to engage with the right people. But the ultimate proof was in the pudding, which is that the African artists all wanted to work with us and spoke incredibly highly of us. And we are literally to today constantly having to turn away artists who want to work with us because of how well we treat our artists and because of our business model and because of our ideals and because of our humanitarian projects and so forth. And because, you know, even when we were young, we realized it wasn't about us. It was about everyone we were working with and about the greater project. And, you know, it was never an ego thing for us whatsoever. Like, the closest thing that got to an ego thing was like, ooh, I got invited to the Roots holiday party. Cha-ching! You know, like, it was like those little side benefits. Like, that was it, you know? But I totally get it. But it was hard for me too, because I was just coming back from Africa, where I was literally the only white person in a village for months at a time. And so, you know, there's just sort of a disconnect there. So there's some early bumps in the road. There was financial bumps in the road we don't really need to go into. That's obviously part of any fringe part of the music industry, and so forth. But luckily, now people are really embracing this stuff, and I can't stress to you enough how much stuff like the Black Panther is an unbelievable boon to what we are doing, to where people are listening to the soundtrack. People think Kendrick Lamar did the entire soundtrack to Black Panther. People, I could tell you I like Kendrick Lamar and the sort of associated soundtrack that he did, of which a couple tracks are in the movie, is great. 95% of the music in that movie was straight up African music. But the fact that people thought it was so cool and not weird and embraced it immediately, no matter where they think it comes from, is a huge victory. Huge victory for us. And I would be lying if I'm not texting Eric every 3 days. He is a very young kid, so he hasn't actually been able to see Black Panther yet, because she's like 5 months old or something. But every 3 days, I'm like, dude, we got to get that music licensing for Black Panther 2. We got to get that music licensing for Black Panther 2. Dude, we have Bambino and Viafar Katori, right? Like, why shouldn't that be in Black Panther 2?
Shalom, malachei ha-shalom, barechuni le-shalom.
Thanks to the Bizzle for being a guest on our show, and thanks to you for listening to our podcast. Catch us online using the handle at The Vinyl Exam or on our website, www.thevinylexam.com. We release new episodes every other week on iTunes and SoundCloud, so make sure to subscribe. And special thanks to our Patreon supporters, Yan Wong and Brian Siebold, and to our executive producers, Austell Gray and Ben Lack. You too can become a producer for our show by visiting our crowdfunding page, www.patreon.com/thevinylexam. Take care. Once again, my name is Sam Ahmed. I'll catch you next time.